And that gives Dreamers in-state tuition. So Arizonans are ready. It was a top vote getter. And Arizonans are ready to see relief, real relief. And what we're saying is that $2 million is not enough, and $25 billion to border security again is creating a issue that for us, what we're saying is we actually need to see more investment in people rather than targeting and deporting our immigrant communities.
Alejandra Gomez, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of Living United for Change in Arizona, or LUCCHA. And I want to thank Ryan Grimm, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept. Ryan, if you could stay with us, we're going to do a post-show interview and post it online at democracynow.org on the big piece that you just released. The railroad fight was the product of 8 years of militant rank-and-file organizing. Railroad unions haven't been known for putting up a fight since the 19th century, but newly radicalized workers forced their way into the national conversation. We're going to talk about that. And folks can go to democracynow.org to see it. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Tammy Warren, Afterin, and Dura Sen, Malkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen Honey, Masood, Mary Conlin, our executive director, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the second Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-the-year fund drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, Oregon and Washington's interstate bridge replacement has a much higher price tag, thanks to inflation. President Biden signs the Respect for Marriage Act into law. And, in international news, 46 countries meet to pledge their aid to Ukraine. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 13th, 2022. KBOO is currently in our end-of-the-year fundraising drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eric Leuschner. Replacing the Interstate 5 bridge between Oregon and Washington just got a lot more expensive, thanks to inflation. 2 years ago, experts said building a new bridge spanning the Columbia River and connecting Oregon and Washington would cost between $3.2 and $4.8 billion. Updated estimates released late last week now put that figure between $5 and $7.5 billion. A number of factors are contributing to the rising estimate, including inflation, supply chain issues, and workforce shortages. Infrastructure projects across the country are all experiencing the same cost crunches. Much of the funding comes from Oregon and Washington states. Some will be collected directly from drivers paying tolls on the new bridge. Federal grants should supply between $1.6 and $2.7 billion. However, most of that funding has not yet been secured. Washington state did earmark $1 billion towards the bridge, and Oregon is expected to match that figure during its upcoming legislative session. Transportation officials have not yet stated how expensive the tolls will be. It is not clear if the new, larger estimate to build the bridge will result in higher tolls than previously predicted. It is also possible the bridge replacement project will be scaled down. Not all aspects can be easily modified. Current plans call for light rail to run alongside the bridge and continue into downtown Vancouver. That component is required to claim more than $1 billion in federal grants. A new bridge has been planned for years in one form or another. Officials from Oregon and Washington previously spent millions on what was called the Columbia River Crossing. Washington lawmakers scrapped that plan in 2013. The bridge is a major commercial thoroughfare. In 2019, more than 143,000 vehicles crossed the bridge daily. About 10% of those were trucks carrying freight. Last January, President Biden himself referenced the project by name during a speech on the importance of investing in improving the country's infrastructure. New protections are coming to parts of the Oregon coast, which boasts a wide variety of wildlife, from birds to sea stars. It includes two stretches of coast near Cannon Beach. Eric Tegedoff has more on this story.
Six stretches of Oregon coast that are home to a diverse array of wildlife are set to receive critical protections. The Oregon Ocean Policy Advisory Council approved new rocky habitat designations for the areas, including Chapman Point and Ecola Point, both of which are north of Cannon Beach. Jesse Jones is the Coast Watch Volunteer Coordinator for the Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition. She says the areas have seen increased visitation, which puts the fragile but vibrant landscape at risk. Jones says Chapman Point, for example, has large boulders teeming with life.
Numerous black oyster catcher nests, and is a resting place for harbor seal pups and adults, and has truly incredible rocky habitat, intertidal diversity, including numerous marine invertebrates, plants.
Chapman Point is set for designation as a marine education area, and Ecola Point, which is just to the north of Chapman Point, is set to become a marine conservation area. The areas contain tide pools and are home to nesting habitats for some of the world's most threatened birds. Jones says the beauty of the process to protect these regions is that it has been community-driven.
The proposals were made and initiated by members of these communities in which these sites are in, and these community members worked very hard to study these sites and get these proposals in.
The decision now goes to the Oregon Land Conservation and Development Commission, which is expected to approve the new designations. Along with the other four designations, the new protections are part of an update to the state's Rocky Shores Management Strategy, which hasn't been changed since 1994. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A student was hospitalized after a shooting outside Portland's Cleveland High School on Monday. The school was in lockdown after the shots were fired. Classes were canceled today, but students could meet with guidance counselors after 11 a.m. and pick up to-go lunches. Police say the investigation is ongoing, potentially involving two vehicles. This is the sixth school shooting in Portland in 2022. Three students were injured in two shootings at Jefferson High School this school year. President Biden signed the Respect for Marriage Act into law today. It officially overturned the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act. Through the act, same-sex and interracial marriages are codified into federal law for the first time. Both were made legal nationwide through Supreme Court rulings, but now they are in federal law as well. The bill passed with bipartisan support. It was led by congressional Democrats, who were joined by 12 Republicans in the Senate and 63 Republicans in the House. President Biden made remarks on the White House lawn today. Here is some of what he said.
Today's a good day. A day America takes a vital step toward equality, toward liberty and justice, not just for some, but for everyone. Everyone. Toward creating a nation where decency, dignity, and love are recognized, honored, and protected. Today, I sign the Respect for Marriage Act into law. Deciding whether to marry, who to marry, is one of the most profound decisions a person can make. And as I've said before, and some of you might remember, on a certain TV show 10 years ago, I got in trouble. Marriage, I mean this from the bottom of my heart, marriage is a simple proposition. Who do you love? And will you be loyal to that person you love? It's not more complicated than that. And the law recognizes that everyone should have the right to answer those questions for themselves without the government interference. It also secures the federal rights, protections that come with marriage. Like when your loved one gets sick and you've legally recognized as a next of kin. For most of our nation's history, we denied interracial couples and same-sex couples from these protections. We failed to treat them with equal dignity and respect. And now, the law requires that interracial marriage and same-sex marriage must be recognized as legal in every state in the nation.
Those were some remarks from President Biden today as he signed the Respect for Marriage Act. New York takes action on hate crimes, including anti-Semitism, and the House waives a budget impasse. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It may not be the same as a physical fight or a physical altercation, but words and images can be painful, and people carry that within them, and that's why we have to let it out. We have to let people know what is happening to this community. Be public about it. Rise up, in a sense.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul announced the creation of a new hate and bias prevention unit, which would lead public education and outreach efforts and serve as an early detection system in local communities. This comes as anti-Semitism is rising in the state and across the country. According to NYPD crime statistics, hate crimes against Jewish people were up 125% from the same period in 2021. Hochul also approved a measure preventing insurance companies from raising rates on people who have filed claims for being the victim of a hate crime. Congress could be deadlocked on a new budget. Senator Chuck Schumer says passing the short-term continuing resolution would buy lawmakers some time, but warned the Department of Veterans Affairs would be especially hard hit.
Last week, the VA wrote Congress a letter warning that a CR would mean a $10 billion shortfall for the VA. That means fewer healthcare workers on the job. It would mean a surge in the backlog of claims.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell is expected to raise interest rates again. It's part of a strategy to reduce inflation to 2%. Peter Morici, a University of Maryland professor, says inflation is not easy to manage.
There's no longer a sense of a coronation as opposed to a contest. And I think in American politics, regardless of what party you align with, or if you're an independent, you align with independents, that's a good thing.
Republicans are wondering about the future of the party following the midterms. Strategist Adam Goodman finds candidates who are parroting former President Donald Trump's rhetoric aren't cutting it. He says it is refreshing that voters are paying attention to the candidate's character, the issues, and what they want for the country. Goodman described how the 2024 presidential election is shaping up.
We are in a very difficult inflationary situation. It is getting very much embedded in wage negotiations and so forth, and we're not taking this seriously enough. It's going to take a great deal of good luck.
John Ray, CEO of FTX, will testify before a House committee about why the company collapsed. He was named CEO after the company filed for bankruptcy. This comes as FTX's founder, Sam Bankman-Fried, was arrested in the Bahamas after U.S. prosecutors filed an indictment against him. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Participation rates show that ships are slowing down on Puget Sound to benefit the region's endangered orca population. Eric Tegedoff has more on the efforts to quiet down Puget Sound.
Ships are getting on board with a program to make Puget Sound quieter for the region's endangered orca population. 61% of vessels participated in a voluntary slowdown in the first 4 weeks, according to numbers released by the Quiet Sound Program. Program Director Rachel Aronson says sound is an essential sense for orcas, but propeller noise interferes with that.
The propeller spins. It creates little air bubbles that explode and collapse. That process is called cavitation. And it turns out that cavitation makes a lot of noise in exactly the sound frequencies that the whales need to hunt and communicate.
The Quiet Sound Program started in 2021 with funding from Washington State, federal partners, and ports. In Phase 1, it helped develop a real-time whale alert system. The volunteer slowdown began at the end of October. It's estimated only 73 southern resident killer whales remain. The Quiet Sound Program has partnered with the shipping industry on this effort. Vice President of the Pacific Merchant Shipping Association, Mike Moore, says the industry has experience with a similar Canadian slowdown program and is excited to do its part to help the endangered whales.
3 knots has been equated to about 50% reduction in noise, so just a little bit of change can have a bigger impact.
Patrick Gallagher heads the Marine Exchange of Puget Sound, which provides shipping location data for the Quiet Sound Program. Gallagher says the program has been transparent about its efforts since its inception, and the shipping industry appreciates this. He says people are thinking about what kind of environmental legacy they want to leave.
We want to think about what type of ancestors we'd want to be, and we're trying to prove that industry can basically run alongside doing what's right for wildlife.
In the next phase of the project, the program is creating an underwater noise map of Puget Sound. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
You're listening to an end-of-the-year fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during the program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In-Depth. At 7, it's For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 32 overnight. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with some peaks of sunshine and a daytime high of 43 degrees. Today in history, in 1925, American actor, entertainer, and comedian Dick Van Dyke was born. His award-winning career has spanned 7 decades. He's known for his roles in The Dick Van Dyke Show, Mary Poppins, and The Carol Burnett Show. The quote of the day is from Dick Van Dyke, who said, quote, "Everybody should dance, and everybody should sing. People say, well, I can't sing. Everybody can sing. That you do it badly is no reason not to sing." Forty-six countries and 24 international organizations began meeting in France today, pledging their aid to Ukraine. Ukraine's needs are large and urgent as winter begins, with falling temperatures and the onset of snowstorms. Russia has repeatedly shelled the Ukrainian power grid, as well as water facilities and buildings supplying other essential services. The attacks have destroyed about half of Ukraine's energy infrastructure. About 12 million Ukrainians, roughly one quarter of the country's pre-invasion population, are experiencing power outages. French President Emmanuel Macron, the international donor conference host, labeled Moscow's bombardment of civilian targets as war crimes. He said the Kremlin is attacking civilian infrastructure because its troops suffered setbacks on the battlefield and that, quote, "the objective is clear. Respond to military defeats by spreading terror among civilians. Try to break the back as it can't maintain the front," end quote. Ukraine's president, Vladimir Zelensky, has argued this kind of support coming from the conference could pressure Russia into pursuing peace. He said a concerted international effort to keep Ukraine's utility systems working could force Russia to negotiate and also prevent Ukrainians from fleeing to elsewhere in Europe. Russia says that by striking civilian infrastructure, its military aim is to weaken Ukraine's defense capabilities and disrupt flows of Western weapons into the country. Zelensky said Ukraine requires electricity generators as much as it needs armored vehicles and vests for its troops. The conference has accumulated more than 1 billion euros in promises of financial aid and in-kind support. All of it is expected to reach Ukraine over the winter months. The Paris meeting also aims to put into place a system to coordinate international aid so equipment donors don't double up. A web-based platform will list Ukrainian civilians' needs and allow donors to show what they plan to supply. Sweden was among the first nations attending the meeting. It announced, quote, "We need to do whatever we can to help improve conditions in Ukraine and also help them fight off the Russian invaders. We're here for them as long as it takes," end quote. A Montana county moves to end law enforcement on the Flathead Reservation. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Lake County Commissioners Monday proposed an ordinance to withdraw from an agreement to provide law enforcement services on the Flathead Reservation. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has more.
The state, Lake County, and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes opted into the federal law known as Public Law 280 in the 1960s. The law requires Lake County to provide law enforcement services on the reservation, but county commissioners say the state isn't paying for the cost of those services, estimated at $4 million annually. In a statement, Governor Greg Gianforte spokesperson Brooke Stroik says the governor's office has tried to help the county find solutions, but wrote, quote, "The legislature, not the governor, has the authority to fund PL 280, unquote. Gianforte signed a bill passed by the state legislature in 2021 to reimburse Lake County for law enforcement costs under PL 280. The bill appropriated $1 for that reimbursement. Lake County commissioners say local taxpayers can't afford to pay for the law enforcement services and that the county will withdraw from the agreement early next year, forcing the state to pick up that work. The county will take public comment on the resolution January 3rd before officially voting on the measure. CSKT spokesperson Shane Morgeau says the tribes declined to comment on the matter. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The film, The Wind and the Reckoning, was one of the highlights at this year's Anchorage International Film Festival, where it won first place in the narrative feature category.
The story I need to tell you is true. I offer and dedicate it to my people, the Native Hawaiian.
The film has been recognized for its authentic portrayal of Native Hawaiians. It's set in the 1800s, just as colonists overthrow the queen and take control of the land. The film takes place in the height of a leprosy outbreak when Hawaiians suspected of having the disease are banished and forced to separate from their families. The film's based on a true story about a rebellion against the provisional government, one that's not well known, even among Hawaiians. Stuart Featherin plays Pa'oa, one of the Hawaiians who was arrested by the government. He says it's a story about love, strength, and a passion for justice. And for him, the movie is more than playing a role, but a responsibility to share the story.
It's even deeper than that as well. It's almost like it's our duty. Like, we have to do this. And it just grows deeper and deeper with us.
Featherin says the movie is an immersion experience in Native Hawaiian language, history, and culture. The Wind and the Reckoning has won numerous awards for its cinematography and storytelling. At the San Diego Film Festival, it was selected as the audience's choice. An indigenous language that has been suppressed by the British government for the past three centuries is now legal, following approval by King Charles this month. Show McPolin reports from Dublin, Ireland.
The Identity and Language Bill was negotiated by Irish and British governments 2 years ago, but it wasn't approved until this month by royal assent. For the first time in history, the Gaelic language now has official status in Northern Ireland, the six counties controlled by the UK. The bill also repealed a 1737 law which banned the use of Irish in British courts. The next step is implementation through the appointment of two commissioners, one for the Irish version of Gaelic and the other for its Scottish counterpart. A longtime language activist called the new law historic and said Gaelic's community of speakers have been discriminated against and marginalized. For National Native News, I'm Sean McPullen in Dublin.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Librarians in Missouri are pushing back on a proposed rule that would ban people under 18 from checking out a book from the library without a parent's permission. It was proposed by the Missouri Secretary of State, and librarians say it amounts to censorship. Mark Moran has the details.
In what the American Library Association has called an unprecedented year of censorship, libraries in Missouri are fighting a rule proposed by the Secretary of State that would require people younger than 18 to have a parent's permission to check out books from public and school libraries. Librarians say this amounts to government overreach and censorship. The rule was proposed by Missouri's Republican Secretary of State John Ashcroft, who's widely thought to be running for governor in 2024. It would require a parent to sign off on a book before their kid could check it out of the library, especially if the book appeals to what the proposed rule calls the prurient interests of the minor. Bob Pretty is a library board member in Jefferson City. He says this is the camel's nose under the tent flap.
The next thing you know, we're going to have people who are saying, well, as government, there are certain books that nobody should read. I can see where this is the kind of thing where government wants to, in one way or another, withhold information from people who have a right to have that information.
Ashcroft has also called on libraries to craft written policies deciding what books are appropriate for which age group, and would then allow parents to challenge those decisions. How each library would be expected to create those lists and how parents could challenge them is not spelled out in the proposed rule, and critics say has intentionally been left vague. Joe Colburn chairs the Intellectual Freedom Committee for the Missouri Library Association. He says if it's approved, the measure would make less information available to people who need it.
I mean, like, this is why we pay tax dollars for libraries, to have access to information. And if that information is controlled kind of for political means, then we're sort of undermining the whole purpose of libraries in general.
Under Missouri law, the Secretary of State's office controls its library system. Ashcroft has said he's not anti-library and that he has no interest in banning books, but wants to let parents decide what their kids read. The law requires a 30-day public comment period before the proposed rule can be finalized. That period is up Thursday. For Missouri News Service, I'm Mark Moran.
As the year winds down, Congress faces more pressure to pass a bill that offers more protections and accommodations for pregnant workers. Its supporters say there are existing laws that help, but workers still face red tape and discrimination. Mike Mullen has more in North Dakota.
In North Dakota and at the federal level, there are protections to prevent discrimination against pregnant workers. But advocates say these individuals are still vulnerable on the job and want passage of a bill to ease concerns. In Congress, the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act would ensure these individuals aren't forced from their jobs unnecessarily or denied reasonable accommodations. Laura Haugen Christensen, a high school teacher in Fargo and local union leader, says it can be a process sometimes for administrators and staff to come together on making things easier for pregnant teachers. She feels having a blanket law might remove hurdles all the parties encounter.
It's not big, nasty government coming in to tell us how to do things. It's just going to affirm that workers are valuable and their families and their health are important, and we're going to do everything we can to make sure they're able to do their jobs well.
And the group A Better Balance says nationally, the legal burden is too high surrounding discrimination cases, with 2/3 of workers not succeeding in their challenges. The bill has bipartisan support but has been mired in broader negotiations. And political observers say when the balance of power shifts in the House next year, passage will likely be more difficult. Amy Jacobson of the group Prairie Action says having these protections in place can also prevent financial hardships from surfacing.
When employees are forced to take unpaid leave for appointments or for other sorts of things, that's a loss of income.
The North Dakota Human Rights Act does have language dealing with discrimination against pregnant workers, but Jacobson and other supporters of the federal bill argue that uniformity is needed to weed out any instances that still surface. In its latest biennial report, the State Department of Labor and Human Rights says it had 16 closed cases of employment discrimination dealing with pregnancy. Mike Moen, Prairie News Service.
Voting rights groups are watching the Supreme Court case Moore v. Harper very closely. It deals with redistricting in North Carolina, and depending on which arguments the court accepts, it could have a wide-ranging impact on voters across the country. This is especially true in Georgia, where Danielle Smith has more.
A Georgia group says the outcome of Moore versus Harper at the U.S. Supreme Court has potential consequences for future elections in the Peach State. The High Court has heard oral arguments in the North Carolina redistricting case, which includes a review of what's known as the independent state legislator theory. April England Albright with the Black Voters Matter Fund says if the court rules in favor of Moore, then state legislators would have unfettered control over how redistricting maps are drawn. She warns not all communities have fair representation when the maps are made by folks with political motivations.
I believe that their mere acceptance of this case is another step towards trying to take away the vital protections that marginalized people have to build their political power in this country and change the quality of life of their communities.
Backers of the independent state legislator theory believe each state legislator should have the ultimate power to draw voting district maps and regulate elections. Constitutional scholars say that isn't what the nation's founders intended, and that the courts should be able to play a role when things like voting district maps are challenged. England Albright says Georgia has also experienced issues with redistricting as the state legislators failed to draw district lines that would give voters a choice of different party candidates. She says, for example, when Republicans redrew the 6th district map to become red, U.S. Representative Lucy McBeth switched to the 7th district, meant she had to run against a fellow Democrat.
And so instead of having those two seats, congressional seats, we only had one, despite the fact that, you know, Georgia is one of those states where there was clear growth in the Black community, for example. So yes, Georgia was impacted, you know, by this power, this unbridled power of the legislators to draw these maps.
She adds, it's important for Georgians to consider their state and appellate court judges as well, since they often make decisions that involve voting rights. Next year, these local judges will be on the ballot and can sometimes offer protections that the federal system does not. I'm Danielle Smith, Georgia News Connection.
You're listening to an end-of-the-year fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 13th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto.